Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Gods Will Not Save You, The Wire Revisited. I'm Willie.
Yes. This is Jakob. Welcome back to the podcast about The Wire, where we're going to take you on a journey, on a play-by-play deep read of the hit HBO show, The Wire.
Anchor.fm/thegodswillnotsaveyou/support is where you can throw us a couple bucks. And let's get right into it. We're here back with a new season, season four, in the first episode, The Boys of Summer.
And we didn't get canceled. We kind of let things go, but, you know, came up with some new ideas, and they brought us back for a fourth season. And it's good to see you back, because I know you want, like, you needed a break, but we're going to do everything related to this season in 3 weeks, and you won't miss anything, Willie. You'll get to go visit your family and all that, and just happen to miss out on the best best podcast season ever. As long as you come back for season five.
Wow, this is getting
but
a little...
But you could create a whole episode and, like, direct the creative...
Damn, so this is getting a little, like, meta right here, where... You're throwing
in. I've been waiting for that joke.
Throwing in some subtle references to the real behind the scenes drama of the production of season four. because we didn't touch upon this talking last season,
You did. You said, you know, for a show that's, like, pretty much planned to end in three seasons, you know, this is crazy stuff.
A little bit. I mean, yeah, they, the creators weren't even too sure if they were going to get extended past the third season. So they kind of wrote the last episode of the third season in mind, kind of, you know, flirting with the idea that they could possibly be canceled. So they wanted to go out on a strong note. But thank God for Chris Albrecht, who gave them a shot at another season and extended them for one more 2 days after season four's premiere. People... I think forget or don't realize how much of a threat or how little of a thread The Wire was hanging on to off the cliff of HBO's, you know, chopping, or they were next on HBO's chopping block because of such low ratings. But thank God for the execs who saw the potential in the content here. So
Cliff Albrecht.
Oh, nice. No. Rescue from a Cliff Albrecht, yeah.
And, of course, my other sorry joke is, like, McNulty.
That's correct.
Wanting to be a movie star and, I guess, also hang out with his young daughter.
Yeah.
be a present dad, which, you know, all good stuff. But they kind of talked him into, or did, you know, talk him into a diminished role and shooting everything in a more concise manner, so that way he can have his family time, recharge, come back for season five with the stipulation that he'll direct an episode, which I've seen a few times but can't remember, and I'm excited to see it, because, like I said, we only got Willie back because we had to guarantee, you know, we guarantee that he'll be back for season five.
This is, there's so many layers to these comments you're making here. Because
it's pretty crazy. I'm pretty crazy. I'm growl.
I like it. I like the energy you're bringing. I like the craziness you're bringing. We're going to need that in season five for how crazy of a season that is. does this also kind of, like, fit into, like, a... our whole theory or our talk from, like, a couple weeks back about how everything is a simulation and how, like, closely the content of season four matches Dominic West's own life. I mean, in comparison, like, with McNulty's character, like, he's becoming more domesticated and is taking, like, a less responsible role by being a patrolman and, like, spending more time at home with BD Russell and her kids. And, like, at the same time, like, you know, being good with his own and just, you know, showing up a lot less, hogging a lot less of the spotlight, so to speak.
That's pretty funny. But then they also, every beginning to a new season, we are just coming off of, you know, refreshing All the Pieces Matter. So it's like, oh yeah, I heard this. Or it's like, no, probably this is from one source. Although, you know, we got some articles and stuff we're going to bring up and pepper in, but they took him out drinking, like Sonia Sun and Andre Royo and his close castmates, and kind of shook him out of, you know, like wanting to, you know, jump ship or leave the show for good. And, you know, maybe that was like the others, you know, the other McNulty, you know, going out having a taste and like, oh, I like, actually, yeah. Partying in Baltimore is pretty fun.
That's great. Yeah.
So glad they did that.
Yeah. Because,
even though, you know, all I'm trying to say is that, you know, you're going to miss a lot without even knowing it, Willie. Bye. By leaving, no, I was kidding.
Yeah.
Okay, Daryl Davis was back. Peace. I'm going. I'm a fraud.
No, all right. Now let's get into Let's get into Snoop's trip to the hardware barn.
Willie was trying to say that, you know, I got to give him the details and the lowdown on this, or because, you know, what is he paying me for if I don't have the geo takes for him? So I was trying to explain, Willie, like, first off, I want to give you credit. Like, oh, do you know it was at a Home Depot? You said it was like CGI looking.
Well, just the sign, the hardware barn sign that like is shown in a shot as Snoop's walking out, looks pretty computer generated, in my opinion. I don't know if that's exactly what happened or not. It seemed like some early 2000s HBO graphics. I mean, we saw similar things with the raising of the towers, but it, you know, still doesn't take away from the power of the scene.
Yeah, it just takes away from my diminished ability to give strong geo takes. That's stupid. But what I was going to say is Dennis Lehane in All the Pieces Matter said, you know, we went down to Home Depot and shot this scene, and it was about, you know, Felicia Snoop Pearson's coming out party, as far as, you know, her turning the corner, you know, from being, you know, more of herself in season 3 and having some lines to more what David Simon determined to be like a serious actor,
right?
Having to go through all these lines. And then I read an article leading up to season 4 from the Baltimore Sun that said, oh, they're filming this teaser and like they're at a hardware store on North Avenue that was called Walbrook and Mill, but then they turn it into Premium Hardware. So I'm thinking, is there another scene with the hardware shop that I'm missing that's referencing something that's not the opening? So that's all I was trying to be like, you know, because I was expecting this to say Premium Hardware, but it said Hardware Barn. So Premium Hardware Barn, we'll just call it a wash.
No, there we go.
I don't know. But yeah, this, like we always have to do, Willie, the first scene of each season pretty much, you know, provides a glimpse into all the themes and metaphors. And why are you like shaking your head like, wow, because you give some really hot takes. And if we could rerun like my season 1 opening, it's like, oh yeah, the drug war, blah, blah, blah. <It's> terrible. So yeah, what do you think about this opening scene, and what, you know, what commentary does it provide? What metaphors are, you know, being conveyed here for us?
No, I mean, this is the first I'm hearing of like that whole thing you're talking about how like the first scene of each season sets up the theme.
Oh, that's the first time. That's the first time you're hearing about it.
Yeah, this is the first time.
We've never talked about it.
Yeah.
Just like Daryl Davis is only in one episode of The Wire.
But anyway, yeah, I think, this is always like the scene that trips me up the most in terms of like getting a complete grasp on what they're trying to say with the opener. Like,
right.
But you know, so this season is all about, is all supposedly about, you know, the idea of education and not just in the classroom, but like in many other aspects of life. And I did notice like something that, jumped out at me pretty clear about this whole interaction that after it takes place between Snoop and the hardware salesman. She says, I learned something, when he was kind of teaching her about like the attributes of this nail gun she's trying to get in order to nail shut the vacant row houses that they're storing dead bodies in. And it's like, you know, he's talking to about something to her that's relevant to her own life and her own experience. And he's like meeting her at eye level to try and like school her on something, even though he doesn't necessarily know that he's giving her a whole new level of education that's going to end up being a lot more destructive to everybody around her.
Yeah, I mean, this is just, yeah, that's, you had another great example, though, a callback to a situation like this.
Oh, yeah.
Earlier in the show, you want to share? Because I thought it was a great.
So great, in the first season, you know, when Wallace was still around and kind of being caretaker for a lot of the younger kids, one of them was like bothering him on how to solve a certain math problem involving like, it's like, you know, one of those classic like math word problems, like if this car is going at this rate, blah, blah, blah. What? And then like Wallace kind of like flips the whole situation on him and applies like the mathematic principles to something that would be applicable to their daily life, you know, dealing drugs, and he immediately understands it. So it's kind of like taking some more real world examples from their real world to, you know, broaden their horizon or their knowledge.
Yeah, Simon was also saying some pretty smart stuff about how, you know, this scene kind of adds some important commentary to the conversation, you know, regarding the American ideal of equal opportunity through education. And maybe those opportunities are not as equal as we would like to think they are.
Ooh.
Not saying that that's exactly happening in this scene, but obviously education at the forefront in a lot of ways,
right,
this season.
Yeah.
But that's from Simon. That's some pretty smart stuff, man. But apparently Ed Burns is like the most intellectually stimulating or like pleasing person that he's worked with. But yeah, and they hate each other a third of the time, and they love each other a third of the time, and then they're like ambivalent a third of the time. Man, this analyzing all this is tearing me up like a tearing my brain up like a, there's like a little 22 in there. Beep, beep, beep,
beep. Yeah.
All right, sorry, man. I'm getting off topic.
No, that's good.
Let's talk a little bit about Ed Burns, Willie, before we break out into our, you know, our storylines and our analysis of those. He's at the forefront in a lot of ways. This is his baby education. Yeah. He waded through all the politics and all that stuff. He's really
ambivalent about it.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
This is it, man. This is his thing.
His home turf, as much as like season two was Rafael Alvarez's specialty and season three was all William F. Zorzi coaching people on the politics talk, Ed Burns steps in here to really get into the intricacies of the school system, since it was, as he likes to say, like, worst. Like, he was like, I served in Vietnam, I was a cop, and I was a teacher, and the teaching was by far the hardest job. So a lot of he's doing what any good like TV writer would do, is he's processing his trauma through storytelling, although he pretty vehemently denies that Presbuluski's storyline is that akin to his own.
Yeah, he's like, I did not shoot anyone. No one ever lost an eye in my custody.
But it was funny because like on the commentary when they're talking about it, David Simon brings up like, oh, like there's some theories on the internet that, you know, this Prez is like a stand-in for you. And Ed Burns is like, no, not even close. I was older. And then he just doesn't elaborate on that at all. It's like, you really are a great writer. You're a man of a few words. You get your point across succinctly.
More, less is more.
Okay.
Just like he told Tristan Lee Wilds, Mac Wilds, Tristan Wilds.
That's what I told Tristan Wilds.
Oh. That's what you told. Yeah.
Well, no, I didn't.
That's we got Tristan Wilds in studio today. I mean, Lee, Mac.
That's what Ed Burns said to him during the audition process.
Didn't they also insult him into like, hey, we're going to just hurl some insults and then we want to just give us a look and then we'll know.
Yeah, that was some fucking method ass shit right there. Probably. I'd say so. Like,
yeah. Or he, like out of 500 kids that read for the part, aside from, I'm assuming, Wilds, who of course plays Michael, They're like, we got one kid who gave that look of like, you know, I could get down or I could get angry.
Yeah.
But he was a corner kid who couldn't act for shit. But anyways, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to tie it all back in. But of course, you know, Ed Burns, Baltimore City, you know, teacher for like probably from 93 up until I imagine they started getting heavy into the corner, or maybe he was still teaching, but he started like he only did about 7 years. And you know, Ed Burns, he's not gonna sugarcoat, because people were saying, oh, it's not that, like, you're a little bit harsh on the whole situation. He's like, no, it's bad. Trust me. I like Willie was talking about Vietnam and him being a combat vet, and he's like, you know, those Teach for America teachers, just 3 months in, they got that 1,000-yard stare. It's about survival.
Yeah.
So it gives, you know, like Willie said, I mean, Willie's scared of kids.
Wait, I was gonna wait to bring that up when we are discussing corporate meeting scene, but
So Ed Burns is the guy. This is like what I am to like a geo breakdown. Ed Burns is to season 4, and what Willie is to like discussing some film stuff that you never heard about and have no idea about, so he can school all the DPs on any set. That's, you know, what Ed Burns means to season 4. So, you know, great guy. I mean, well, I don't know him personally yet.
What he brings to this season, I think, is an authenticity and a passion for illustrating the issues of a lot of kids' fates who seem predetermined by their upbringings, is a big reason as to why a lot of people claim season 4 as their favorite, because we get like a really detailed behind the scenes look at, like, you know, what Avon Barksdale or Omar or Bubbles could have been like as kids. Like, we kind of see the prototype for all of them as youngins, really. Like, Dookie more or less becomes Bubbles down the line. Michael is Omar. Yeah.
Omarlo.
And Randy, like, you know, getting shaped by his negative experiences in the group home, probably becomes like a soldier or an enforcer. And Naaman is, I don't know, he's not his dad, that's for sure. He's like the rare person that can get out and create his own circumstances, really.
Naaman is Poot if Poot was, you know, like a motivational speaker/shoe salesman.
There we go. Nice way to no.
But yeah, I mean, and it all comes back to Ed Burns and his ability to work with the casting directors and finding these phenomenal actors and making sure that they all fit pretty much, you know, perfectly as in their role, and were able to, you know, help tell those really detailed, intricate stories.
I mean, it's like, it's not often talked about how hard it must be to get excellent performances out of kids, because they were talking about like, oh, they need to still look like children, or they have to have like the stamp of childhood on their face, because if you're a kid actor, you're going to be like having all these like affectations and stuff that reads as very like actor, like without really having any experience of your own. So they didn't want it to seem artificial, which is why like the writers, I guess, like created whole arcs for each of the actors to study, so they could like have the characters in their bones. And then Robert Chu, did a lot behind the scenes of like helping them out and coaching them and setting up like a really good rapport between all of them. And this all contributes to making like these 4 actors really compelling characters in the midst of like all these other, you know, monumental characters we've come to know and love over the past 3 seasons. So it's quite an achievement that doesn't get enough credit a lot of the time. Certainly didn't get enough credit during the award season after this season aired.
All right, man. So that was fun. That was compelling. I feel super like, I'm ready to go, man.
All right. And that was it for our episode.
What if we, I think our lives would be a lot easier if like that was our podcast. All right. So this podcast episode, we're just going to talk about Marlowe's fan fiction and like his background story. And then, all right, 20 minutes later.
Yep.
All right, man, let's upload it. Right? No, yeah. No. Let like neurotic Jakob like, a little breath there. No, no, that is not the actual. That's the 1800 block of Guilford is the correct. We were at the 1600. I said that. Let's ADR in some background. Do you want to talk about like what Chris and Snoop get into after they get their new stuff, or I don't know, wherever you want to go with it?
Well, Chris and Snoop get into killing people and then covering up the evidence by covering their corpses in lime.
Yeah.
As you can see, we're the Guns Wired podcast, the Cars Wired podcast, and we're also all about like home improvement and stuff like that. We know.
But is this home improvement, is this like an angle? Is this like some like really twisted spin on the whole like homicide detective need home improvement stuff?
I know, right? I know all the materials that the lieutenant is using for his beach house and like how much it's going to cost and the square footage.
Yeah, like... Where's Barlow, man? The Marlow could have used Barlow.
That is the fan fiction right there. Marlow and Barlow. Yeah,
Barlow has become like some kind of Herc spinoff, but instead of working for Greasy Levy, he works for now like drug organizations on like improving their like murderous infrastructure.
I feel Marlow probably has some like dirt on him, so he keeps him employed.
Yeah. So they kill some people and we see how like sociopathic Chris is. Gain a little more insight into his character.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've seen him shoot, you know, Avon's muscle in the face and almost kill Avon.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, a little like they're taking it up a notch.
They're
obviously
leveling up. Yeah.
Yeah. So pretty wild stuff. And that is, I don't know how far you want to take that storyline because they end up eventually going to kill Lex, but we got to like provide a little more context before we get into all that, I guess. Or I mean, everyone's like, if you're listening to this, you've seen the show at least twice probably. Does it really matter? Like,
yeah,
we're still like lining this all up to be as if someone is rewatching the show for the third time while listening to our podcast as a guide,
right?
Which might happen someday in like 15 years, you never know, right?
Maybe.
But
Yeah, they'll just release DVDs of our podcast and we'll become popular that way.
Yeah.
No. But yeah, so we see Chris and Snoop kind of like acting out Marlowe's desire of keeping things relatively quiet and not having a bunch of bodies show up where police can find them. So they're keeping things pretty under wraps and moving Marlowe's operation on at a nice clip, or you know, they're winning the war, so to speak, or whatever. Avon and Proposition Joe are kind of like diminishing in relevance in the Baltimore drug trade.
Yeah, they're like antiques at this point. He's like Prop Joe's turned into one of those like old kind of on again, off again clocks that he tinkers with.
But Lex, who is working with Bodhi, is complaining that his ex-girlfriend, or his the mother of his child, right?
Yes, baby. Or yeah. I don't want to get into like assuming things, but the mother of his child.
Patrice,
his baby mama.
Yeah, his baby mama Patrice is sleeping with Fruit, who we all know and love to hate, is like one of Marlowe's top enforcers. He got into that whole spat with Cuddy in the last season, showed himself to be a really hateful character. So Lex takes it upon himself to shoot him dead as he's walking out of a club with Patrice, which prompts Marlowe to respond of having him killed, and only him. He doesn't want to start all this bloodshed. He has, you know, his organization's, you know, longevity in mind. So he doesn't want to spill too much blood. And yeah, that's what kind of ties everything into Randy getting involved, because little Kevin asks him to deceive Lex into meeting Patrice at a playground late at night. By the way, how dumb does Lex have to be to buy that story?
Yeah, he's like some kid that I might have bought Skittles from once. Is like, hey, Patrice wants to see you. It's
like your ex-girlfriend, yeah, who just saw you murder her current boyfriend.
Yeah, exactly. She's coming around. You just gave her, you know, like extreme PTSD for the rest of her life. Yeah. And now, yeah, she wants to just kick it at the park behind Fort, which I don't even know what the hell that meant. It's really pissing me off that I can't get that geo triangulation. But Fort is like a huge thoroughfare through South Baltimore and like Locust Point. So I don't know what the hell, because this obviously is in West Baltimore. Sorry, I did get it. And by the way, also, little Kevin is such an asshole because then he involves Randy to begin with. Like, the kid's already given you, like, you know, convenient access to
candy.
Yeah, the candy, yeah, junk food. I mean, look at him. But yeah, sorry.
Nah, it's all right. So yeah, that's how Randy gets intertwined with that whole crew and forever alters the trajectory of his life and makes him become a tragic figure down the line, as opposed to the sweet, fresh-faced youth we see in this episode.
So I don't know if you're going to transition, but I'm obviously manically searching for something here because I've been waiting for this. I'm like, well, not waiting, but yeah, I have been. I mean, what else? I got, this is all I have, Willie. But the whole death of fruit thing, and I was telling you, you know, like annoying you with, oh yeah, Willie, remember that one sentence from that 13-page little like PDF article I sent? We had to zoom in.
West Side Story, yeah.
Yeah. So West Side Story is like the Easy Money, which was about little Melvin, you know, about to Donnie. So it's just about like Donnie Andrews' life, and then I guess he had one of his buddies was named Fruit Loop, and I probably, you know, talked the story to death, but it's pretty crazy to me at least. I sent it to Willie. He's like, yeah, it was interesting. Okay. Yeah, by the way, man, this one film's coming out, and basically Donnie was supposed to kill Fruit at the behest of Warren Bordley, but Fruit Loop, but they call him Prude, I guess, you know, yeah, which maybe a coincidence playing the name game here. And Donnie didn't want to, so he would like warn him off at one other time when Donnie killed someone and obviously got locked up for it. And then another time, apparently him and his friend Shorty even fabricated a story about Fruit dying and showed Warren Bordley a clipping of an article, like, you know, of a person similar in age to throw him off Fruit's trail. But then Fruit actually got sent to Hagerstown, the jail up northwest of Baltimore, and he somehow got struck by lightning. So it was like in 1987, and either Fruit Loop's real name was Stanley Black or Anthony Tyree. I think maybe I'm going to go with the younger guy, who's Anthony Tyree, but I don't want to like offend anyone if any family ever hears this. But yeah, it's like the gods will not save Fruit. Anyways, Fruit dies, and he was just trying to probably get his clubbing on. In the CC, the closed caption, it says Paragon, but I'm like, it has to be Paradox, right? That's the big time club with the, you know, K-Swift, RIP used to perform there, and Rod Lee and all them.
Yeah, but he didn't want to give somebody a ride to Woodlawn.
Yeah, exactly. There you go, man. Geo, Willie, Geo, Geo. It's fun, right?
Yeah.
Okay, Willie's like, let's move on.
I'll try to get more handle on it for sure.
Great. So Marlo's, you know, keeping things relatively clean.
Right.
You know, as far as the appearances to those on the outside are concerned, which is throwing the major crimes unit off his trail, right?
Right.
You want to get into that?
Yeah, exactly. It's
good, like, we transition in a roundabout way because
yeah,
you led us there. Oh, wait, did I? say let's talk about Chris and Snoop because they were
yeah
god damn it in a car. So anyways, yeah, let's talk about them. Misguided Kima and Lester and everyone kind of is.
Sidner misses Prez.
Oh yeah, he's like, I could turn around the corner if it gets too dark and he might shoot me in the face, but I miss him because of this paper trail's out of control.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I mean, Sidner has shown himself to be, everybody has their strengths. Prez is good on the paper trail and Sidner is good at going undercover under Bubs's tutelage.
Yeah.
Lester is pestering Assistant State's Attorney Rhonda Perlman about getting subpoenas for some political figures that are involved in drug money or something like that, and she's upset because there's an election coming up and it's going to be career suicide for her, which Lester couldn't really care less about. He's not paying attention to any election stuff like that. And we also have Kima and Lester kind of taking advantage of their new soft lieutenant's soft attention to, like, the case at hand and how he's, like, really obsessed with, you know, building out his beach house or his retirement house or whatever.
Yeah.
So they have a unlikely ally in a lazy lieutenant, and they're just kind of running free with their own intuition at this point.
If only he could have become more involved, he would have somehow utilized his brain, his beautiful mind for contracting to crack the whole case with Marlo and the Chris and Snoop and the nail guns. He probably, would have been, no wonder they kept him out of the storyline, because he would have ruined it for all the viewers. It doesn't work like that. How do you sit there sometimes and look at me, like, spew these BS takes and be like, yeah, yeah, I could. That's exactly how TV writing works.
I have to just drink a lot to numb the...
Oh, yeah? Stupefy?
No.
Okay, so what else you want to... Is that all we're going to talk about? Because, I mean, that's pretty much it, right? I mean, we pretty much nailed that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
27 caliber?
Nice, we nailed that row house shut.
Oh, shit. Sweeping it under the rug.
You want to get into a little bit of Carcetti Hall?
Oh yeah, Carcetti Hall, man. So he has a meeting at a maybe it's the same famous diner where he likes to go with Burrell, or where Burrell took him to.
Is that Werther's? Maybe. Is that what it's called?
Gio Willie. Damn. Willie's skull. He's like, what do I pay? I'm just going to start doing Gio now. You got nothing for us, man.
Werner's.
There you go. Brilliant, man. I'm going to add it to my map.
Werner's Diner.
Werner's Diner.
Low-key, old-fashioned eatery serving breakfast sandwiches and Greek-American classics since 1950. 231 East Redwood Street, Baltimore, Maryland.
Review. Are we already like half an hour behind?
Oh, here we go. I like this. If you, I could rate... It's a one-star review from... one-star review from... all one word, you are good, Johnson. Says you are good, all one word, lowercase, space bar, capital J, Johnson. And he gave it one star, or she gave it one star about a year ago. If I could rate them a zero, I would. The food is terrible and the food is overpriced for what you get. I've tried them on two other occasions and wasn't happy. This is my third time and I won't be returning. I ordered a simple hamburger cooked well done with fries. I got a burger that was burned, not char, but burned so black that I had to scrape off the burn. The fries were salty, but I am noticing that everything they make is salty. whomever the cook is, they are obviously unhappy or lack culinary skills for food preparation. I will not be returning. Worst food in downtown Baltimore ever. And then there's 4 exclamation points after that.
The only question is, are the cooks, or is Werner's saltier than One Star Johnson?
Yeah, that's pretty funny. All right, sorry, didn't mean to derail here. So Tommy Carchetti is with Young Tony.
Yeah, nice. Young Tony. Tell us about Coppola. That's who plays him. I thought he was like, he's not
Sam Coppola.
Yeah, he's not any relation to Francis Ford, right? I didn't see anything.
Yeah, I don't see anything either.
But he just seemed like someone. I thought it was a famous political cameo because they're obviously, I think, making a parallel to Young Tommy, who was Thomas D'Alessandro the Third, Nancy Pelosi's brother, which is something we never even really touched on last season. I just thought, since, you know, everyone knows how much we love her anyways, we just didn't need to mention that there were some like campaign flyers in the opening credits of season 3 for Pelosi.
Right.
So, yeah. But anyways, Young Tommy, he was the mayor 67 to 71. So that's kind of what they're referencing after with Carchetti and D'Agostino. And we could get into all that, but, you know, That time frame. But what do you think about their conversation? If I don't want to jump ahead too far, between, you know, Young Tony and Tommy.
Well, he says, their conversation over cold coffee, where he tells them the days of the white mayor in Baltimore are over.
Yeah, that's it. Or is that what you think about the conversation? Like, it's just like how a conversation over cold coffee about white Baltimore mayors would go. But that's what it's about. Oh, my God.
But you had some good intel on, like, the actual figure of Tommy D'Alessandro the Third.
The Third, yeah. Did what I just say not satisfy your...
Well, you have, like, a little blurb about him in this Google.
What? I do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Known to have courage and stood for civil rights.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he was kind of regarded, you know, as someone who maybe was like, had courage during the really turbulent times after the murder of Martin Luther King Jr., where Baltimore was experiencing a lot of rioting, you know, thankfully to Little Melvin, Young Tommy had some support and Little Melvin telling people to stand down so I can go sell my drugs and stuff. No. But yeah, I mean, he just, you know, his dad was the mayor after World War II, pretty much through the 50s. I don't know all the details about his track record, but, you know, this was a time like, I think actually, yeah, his dad, I mean, give him credit that he did at least uphold like Brown versus Board of Education and all that, because, I mean, Baltimore is still, like we talked about, and like the northernmost southern city, right?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I mean, Young Tommy, you know, he kind of wasn't really popular with the more conservative crowd because some people felt like he allowed too much rioting and gave too much leeway to more radical, you know, black activists and stuff. And, you know, he just had like pretty solid record amongst, you know, the black population of Baltimore. And yeah, so that's like maybe what they're trying to embody here with Young Tony, where he's like, well, you know, I was the last one. Like, you know, it's over now, though.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, is that kind of what I really kind of
thinking? Yeah.
So, yeah, but then they mentioned Spiro Agnew later on, who, like,
I only know as the vice president to Richard Nixon. I didn't know any of his backstory before that.
Yeah, so he was like pretty active in Baltimore County in like the 50s, I think. And then he became the governor in 66, the governor of Maryland. And he was like a moderate Republican, but he did win like some of the black vote. But then during the riots that Young Tommy was dealing with in the city, his response was like pretty MAGA. It was like, oh, let me call in, you know, moderate black like leaders and reverends and all the clergy and, you know, important figures in Baltimore. We'll have a meeting and then I'll just berate them and belittle them and tell them that they're, you know, encouraging the radicals like Stokely Carmichael and Rap Brown and like encouraging the looting and rioting. And then like it galvanized the white people, like probably, you know, what we saw in season two.
Right.
To, you know, they're like garrisoned in their neighborhoods, you know, and applauding and supporting and calling in to show their, you know, their true like feelings for their patriotic governor who's standing up to these radical, you know, sounds like, you know, sounds familiar, right?
Yeah.
So, but then it was kind of like, you know, he was Richard Nixon's president's, our vice president, like, you know, I probably not have learned more about his past in Maryland than I do know, like with the whole Watergate thing, which I'm sure you are more versed on or,
I did a report on Nixon in the fifth grade, but a lot of the details that I researched for that report are escaping me now, unfortunately.
Tricky dick.
It might not even be that applicable to this specific podcast episode.
Never underestimate, you know, the validity of a 23-page handwritten Charquin report. Nice. But I mean, Spiro had to resign in 73 because apparently he was up to some shady stuff in Maryland prior to the presidency, and even maybe, you know, while he was vice president, like with kickbacks in Baltimore County, all sorts of crazy stuff. So hey, maybe we'll do another book report or another report.
Jesus.
20 years later, nice. Post fifth grade.
Nice. So we also get a peek into what Herc has been up to in this little season break. And he's now part, what is he, like Secret Service or what do you call, like for the mayor? And he's still kind of uncomfortable with like some of the homophobic jokes that are said at his expense.
Does that statement his colleague makes remind him maybe of
Gus Triandos?
Yes.
The Gus Triandos fiasco.
Yeah, where he's like, wait, what? That's what I knew, that's what people would think about me when I said that. Like, do you think he's angry at Carver in that moment? Like, this guy has to have some intel and dirt on me.
I mean, it's just illustrating how much he will never fit in.
Yeah.
And he's a bad guy. We also get a glimpse into how different Clarence Royce's life on the campaign trail is to Carchetti's. Royce is at like a swanky, like groundbreaking ceremony for like waterfront condos or something, like at some development, and we have like famed KKK rehabilitator Daryl Davis in the audience, who I guess wasn't working at the Mondo Mart that day, so he was in attendance.
Is he scoping out Herc or Ed Bowers, one of the speakers with Royce? You think he knows something we might know about Herc?
But also, it's a pretty stark parallel to Tommy Carchetti at the retirement community. Not getting any votes, obviously, and people asking him if it's taco night.
It's Taco Tuesday.
And I think this had a lot to do, why these parallels are so effective. Probably still William F. Zorzi chiming in with the experience of, you know, him covering multiple doomed political campaigns from the start. So,
I mean, yeah, Carchetti moves beyond that that fateful encounter at the Bel Air Edison Senior Rec Center, and he hits the road. Carchetti, like we said, not necessarily progressive. Or you've hammered this home. I want to give you your due credit that he's not, you know, the progressive necessarily that we, you know, we hope him to be, or, you know, but apparently there's polls out there amongst fans that there are people who just still voted for him. Obviously they're not listening to Willie and the Gods Will Not Save You on that, but he's dropping some pretty, strong language about his city and, you know, basically S-hole country in it.
Right.
In a lot of ways. He's like, Middle East, all over, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, although I can get into the geo, he's like, I'm like, Oliver. Oh yeah, man. That's Amsterdam. Oh wait, Amsterdam is over on Vincent Street. Oh, is that why he thinks it's a shithole? No, wait. The East Side is not the East Side. The East Side is the West Side and the West Side is the East Side, but it's still the Middle East. And that's Fallujah. Okay. You're following me.
This is a simulation talking.
Yeah. So more parallels. I know you're like a resident, Iraq War
knowledge of the Iraq War parallels kind of ceases with the end of season 3, to be honest.
I sent you Ed Burns editorials where it's like juxtapose against like Iraq War clippings.
Oh yeah,
that's pretty crazy stuff, man.
Yeah, but they didn't tie it. They're just two different articles.
They're like Ed Burns The Wire always making parallels with the War on Terror. Here, we're going to sandwich this Ed Burns editorial with two articles about, like, the Iraq War and Afghanistan. Dude.
Oh, shit.
Simulation! Simon was still in with the sun. He, like, snuck into the editorial room and just, he designed that page.
Pretty great sharp turn that the actor Aidan Gillen makes in the moment of where he's really ragging on the city and all of its problems, and then he does a complete 180 in his attitude when he goes to meet with some of his constituents who are giving him like a tour of the neighborhood and why it's so dilapidated and fucked up, and he has to put on that, you know, political, like he's using political calculus to turn up the charm and use that smile and show that he's capable of doing good in this city, so... nice little composition they have there with them walking down the street, and you see the boarded up row house in the foreground with the "if animal trapped, call 414 blah 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 blah
410
sorry,
the nail gun 410, that was the first model. Dude, it's the area code of Baltimore.
Oh shit. But yeah, so he's looking at all the problems that are very visible to anybody walking down the street, but without their knowledge, there's a whole world, a whole village of pain behind these boarded up row houses that nobody even knows about, creating more, you know, innumerable amounts of problems for everybody that, you know, they're still not aware of, like I said.
Yeah, the trash in the alleys is really just the tip of the iceberg as far as the problem.
Right.
But
right.
What do you think about him? So he's 2 hours late then, the next spot they show up to where he runs into Tony.
Yeah.
Gray.
Yeah.
Old Tony Gray. Yeah. Old Tony. No. Pissed off hyphy Tony. No, but so is he 2 hours late just because that's like a, you know, residual of they've been behind 30 minutes to each appointment, it's all built up? Like the lady was talking about taco night when they cut the scene, she really just kept going on and on about like, let me tell you about some recipes I actually have, young candidate. And then that whole scene we didn't even get a glimpse into, and Salisbury steak was really just the tip of that iceberg. I'm just saying, is he 2 hours late because that's what's happened and that's a completely logical scenario, or he really was like getting into, oh shoot, this is what it actually feels like to be a politician helping out my constituents that can't even call in because Royce is blocking them, and like, this is what it's all about. The campaign and fundraising I hate, but I'm getting your opinion because I know he's like code switching, he's slimy, he's greasy, but
I mean,
you know,
what do you think? I feel like you hit on something really good there. And it's probably a mixture of both because, he acknowledges to Reggie Cathay's character, whose name I can't.
Norm?
Yeah.
Norman?
He tells Norm, like, I know, I'm sorry I'm late, but, you know, Norm is kind of happy with his performance in this moment. Like, don't even worry about it. We saw you doing some good work there with community members. So this is overall a positive for the trajectory of your campaign. So I think it is having to do a lot with him being like, oh, this is... It's a moment of realization for him that, you know, he needs to put his work more fully into some of these some of these areas that, yeah.
Help Miss Simmons, Reverend Garnett, and the black constituents of your city, and I'll applaud you. And then I'm still not voting for your white ass.
Right.
That's pretty.
Yeah.
He's just messing with them, right?
The last white person he voted for was Bobby Kennedy. Yeah.
But that's crazy. Norm's a great, I forgot how much like of a likable character he is.
Yeah. Great actor. Gone too soon for R.I.P. sure.
There was some interesting commentary about, you know, Carchetti and polls. We see him in his element, or out of his element, having to call fundraise. They lock him in a room, basically, it seems like. And then they're monitoring his out, like the phone line. But Carchetti's got all those tricks up his sleeve, and he's just playing darts and calling around. And then with ease, he'll just raise $4,000.
I know.
And be like, wait, your kid can't give me more? Like, just put it in their name, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, like, I feel like there's more transparency or awareness of this issue about how politicians have to, like, beg for money and, like, how, you know, soul-sucking and terrible of a job it is. Like, you know, all this stuff with, you know, campaign finance is, I feel like, maybe I'm naive about this, a much more prominent issue in today's like political discourse or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I gotta say, like, one tiny detail that I love in this whole montage of him being stuck in this room, being forced to like beg for money, is like a brilliant piece of set design where there's like a calendar like taped up on the wall behind him, or like a counter like counting how many days are left until the election or whatnot. And like one, like I think like the number 10 or like the date of the 10th is circled, and it's just written next to it as fuck in capital letters. And at the bottom it says like fuck days to go, and like a lot of like the numbers are like furiously scribbled out, and it's like, damn, did they just have like Aidan Gillen like channel Carchetti when the cameras weren't rolling, and they're like, just, you know, mess up the set as much as you can, like Carchetti would, so we can.
No, that what if that's like also a writer's room calendar that Simon was using and just like tormenting. He's like, I'm Carchetti now. Fuck. They're like, all right, man. Okay, I'll create this. I gotta unpack the story.
Hey, lackey, throw this calendar out. Wait a minute. Yeah. I'm envisioning a scene here where this could be a good bit of set design.
Yes, welcome. But okay, so since we give you the deep read, you know, where else? What other podcasts are you going to hear about gerrymandering and district redistricting? Because Carchetti's pissed that the 6th district is now, just as your neighbor's pissed, pissed about how black it is apparently now. Yeah. And Norm like chides him back because he's just awesome in his comebacks. He's like, well, that's because they did that to help your white ass in the 1st district. Right? Is that basically it?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Really smart stuff there. from Ed Burns. And oh no, that was not, he's like, god damn it, I just wanted school stuff. Yeah. You're still talking about gerrymandering. But I looked into it, Willie, because, you know, what else am I going to use these archive subscriptions for? But I couldn't really find, apparently now the 6th district is way up in like Park Heights and Northwest Baltimore. But so that threw me off. I'm like, wait, what? How does that even make sense? Like, I guess, yeah, you could redistrict that, and then, you know, even if it's not near the 1st district. But then I figured out that in the, like, up till the 90s, and I don't know when the switch happened, but in, you know, the 90s, like late as 95, the 6th district was still in South Baltimore and basically would touch up against the 1st district. So it's pretty, makes a lot of sense that that could have, like, you know, like there could have been an ebb and flow between those districts. But then I found reports that are like, you know, change 2% of the demographic, which I don't know how much that would impact the voting polls, right. But you know, it's like, it makes sense though. Maybe they want it like more white people in the predominantly white 1st district, which is like East Baltimore, where we saw all the dock stuff going down probably.
Yeah.
So there you have it. Are you Is that compelling, Willie?
Yeah, that was really sad.
I was going to email you, like, look at this 1983 redistricting map. And you're like, dude, it's like 3:30 on the day we're going to record. Look at it.
I would have looked at it.
Here's a story from 1995 where this Italian dude is running in the 6th district, which is now predominantly black. So just in like a decade and a half.
Listen, I watch and read everything you sent me.
You are really good about it.
I don't know if I could say the same for you if you ever watched that like 19-minute Romanian film I sent you.
I knew you were going to pull that up and be like, you never watched the Romanian movie. And remember when you said I have to be in the mood for the Romanian movie? And you're like, what the hell does that supposed to mean? I don't have to be in the mood for Doughboy's Cash Out. All sorts of side talk videos and crap you send me, but I haven't watched it. Send me the link right now and I'll watch it when I get home.
I forget what it is. It's all
okay.
Good.
I'll go back as far as I can. No, I really wanted to watch it.
I'll figure it out.
Our relationship has evolved since then. That was like over a year. Yeah. That was a long time ago.
It was probably like 9 months ago.
I do now try to reciprocate and be like, you know, I send Willie a lot more stuff, even if it's like pertinent.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's like interesting stuff. But anyways, that's all I had about the redistricting. And
yeah.
It's so crazy, the details that they're like, how average viewers are screwed. That's true. Like the Royce, I was like, you got to pony up and give me that 4K. And then you're like, what the hell is he talking about with Ed Bowers and a photo shoot on Boston Street? Right. And then you're like, oh, 4K, that's what Carcetti's going for. That's the max.
Yeah.
They explain it.
This is before Citizens United, right? Is that like a landmark case that like made it like almost you could donate unlimited amounts of money or like corporations could donate? I don't know.
Tell me more, man. I don't.
That's as much as I know about it.
You know a lot of stuff, man.
But what else were we talking about?
You know a lot of stuff, man.
They bring up the whole 4,000 number and it seems arbitrary, and then like you don't catch, some people won't catch on. In the episodic commentary, they were talking about how like there's a set piece or a gag that like when Carcetti is getting dropped off at home, like he leaves his shoe on the front lawn and then the next morning like he sees his shoe and tosses it back to his wife. And David Simon was kind of like, oh, yeah, like 10% of our audience will get that joke, that was the shoe that he, you know, dropped while coming home from the night before. And it's like, we have so many things like that, that like 80% of our viewers won't get. But if you miss it, you know, well, fuck it. Just keep up and move on. Like, and that's kind of like how I see like our podcast, like where we drop so many random names and issues and geographical locations. And if they can't keep up, then just, you know what? Fuck you guys. We're moving on.
Oh, shit. We're going to La Salsa. Oh, shit.
No.
Yeah, yeah. But seriously.
No, hopefully you guys can track everything we're doing. We love all of you. Thank you for sticking with us.
It's fun. But okay, in all seriousness, this episode, The Boys of Summer, it's like one of the main themes is kids don't vote, right? Aside mm-hmm. from the education, this is obviously we talked about from the jump that's really what this season's getting to, you know, telling stories of, you know, how these characters evolve. And like Willie had made some really, you know, brilliant points there about this is how, you know, Avon could have come to be, or Marlo, or anyone.
Yeah.
And things are much more nuanced and complicated than, you know, the media or whoever, you know, wants to frame it in simplistic terms. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, this is like also for me personally, Willie, this is actually the first episode of The Wire that I ever saw. So,
right.
Spoilers. No, not really. I was in high school and a TV communications class, shout out to Mr. Kaler. And it was like a senior class that most people just, I think were in to just, you know, like sail through the last semester and like goof off. And you're looking at me like really intensely, like that is not what education. We needed like an Ed Burns there. No, no, it was a cool class, but I mean, you know, a lot of people took it seriously because that's where the weekly or bi-weekly videos for Homeroom were produced. And, you know, some really like talented people came out of there. Shouts out E-Rock. Mm-hmm. No, but, yeah, so we would watch in between, you know, projects or whatever you had to do to complete, you know, the basic requirements for the class. We'd watch film, like parts of movies or, you know, episodes of TV shows, and then have to summarize it or, you know, provide analysis, write like a 2-page paper. And then he showed us this episode and I was like, man, what is this? This is crazy. I'm like, where is this? You know, it's like a whole different world, obviously, in Baltimore. I didn't really know at the time. And they're throwing these pee balloons. And I'm like, oh, me and my friends did that once, but we just like suburban kind of like privileged kids in a way, just chucking water balloons.
Right. Yeah.
These are like kids are doing it to like fight for, you know, their survival.
Yeah.
It's like what you kind of fantasize about, like, man, when we grew up, I wish we could like have these stories, but removed, like in a vacuum, removed from the actual trauma that is attached right. to the kids who, you know, that these stories are, you know, attached to.
Yeah. I love what David Simon and Ed Burns, like have to say about like the direction of this episode. They're talking about how brilliantly Joe Chappelle took on the directing duties of this episode and how it's very reminiscent of their childhood until it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like certain aspects of it, like the camaraderie and like getting stuff from the ice cream truck, that's all like it brings things back. But then they realize like, oh shit, like we were just as young as these kids were once, and they had to deal with trauma on a daily basis, and you know, some were more or less forced into the drug dealing profession.
You got your corner kids and the stoop kids, which is what Ed Burns loves to talk about, right? And we'll get into more of that as it relates to the classroom. But, you know, if there's a rock, this is what Ed Burns had like created an example of, that the stoop kid will be like, oh, you can build something with this. And the corner kid will be like, look, that's a weapon. And then, you know, we see this like neighborhood fight that we're going to talk about, which I kind of buried in my little tale of like, oh, this is the first episode I ever saw. And I don't know why the fight scene stuck out to me the most, but maybe that's what I was getting into. It's like, oh man, like I grew up, like we kind of mess around, but then it's like, oh yeah, I never like had the courage to like really fight back against the bullies, but I didn't leave you like naming.
Right. Exactly.
We'll get into that. All right. So yeah, I mean, first off, we get introduced to Bodie's corner, right? Where he's putting in some work and Naaman's there.
Yeah.
And he, unbeknownst to us at the time, you know, like he's going to be one of the central characters in the group, you know, and the boys, right?
Right.
And Bodie's like, this kid is a joke, basically, talking about it's just because of his dad. And we don't even know the connection, right?
Right. We don't even know who his dad is yet.
Weebay.
Yeah.
I still can't get the like, oh, which voice do I have? Like, is this, I'm talking to someone who's watched this show like a million times, or how am I supposed to?
Yeah.
Am I just getting it all wrong, really? I'm having like an existential like simulation crisis.
You're doing a good job.
Anyways, yeah. So, I mean, they're like, they want to do kid stuff too, right? They want to go catch pigeons and go to Mondawmin Mall and buy some back to school clothes because it's summer.
Right.
And Bodie's just like a great role model. Jesus.
He's like, yeah, you know, I'll pay you for what you did today, but you got to come early the next day to make up for time loss. And
he's a early, he's a late to work, early to play motherfucker. And without social promotion, he wouldn't even be going into eighth grade they're going to, right?
Yeah.
They wouldn't even be in middle school. I remember saying that to someone once. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, like they do things like social promotion. They're like, what is that? Which is like, you know, Ed Burns also providing commentary on that and how this inherently broken school system just promotes kids because it's like go along to get along. They don't want to address the real issues. So you end up in eighth grade and not being able to read for the audition to play one of these characters,
right,
which Seth Mann talked about.
Yeah.
Depressing stuff. But yeah, that's a pretty sad state of affairs. So I just don't know. Ed Burns, you know, seems like a great guy, but then he's like, you know, these kids, they go on to college and it's like some BS college and they're home in 6 months because they, you know, they're insecure. And I'm like, But like, what data do you have to prove that like all like 80% of City College graduates, they don't last more than a semester in a college, a BS college, because that's what they got into. I'm like, okay, come on. Like,
yeah.
But what do, I don't know anything.
Yeah, neither of us do. no, I'm just kidding.
All-star substitute teacher.
Yeah, no, you yeah, you're the presbo of the Hayward Unified School District.
Drawing parallels with the director commentary, like, this reminds you of, like, your childhood or our childhood growing up as friends until it doesn't. But then it's like there are still, there's just like a thread of relatability where it's like,
right.
You know, when we have like some friends who might get like too carried away and they're like, yeah, season four is basically like, how was it the middle school? I'm like, dude, we went to the same middle school. It was like gate class and like yeah. your class. Like, was it that?
Yeah.
I mean, there, you know, there's a big difference, but there are some, you know, definite instances watching this season where it's like, oh yeah,
yeah,
you know, we're a far cry from there, but like, yeah, I could see there's definitely some like corner kids probably, and like just three or four kids like that in a class,
right?
You know, even if they're not like true corner kids, they just think they are. I mean, you know, whatever, but it can make a huge difference. But right. you shouldn't track them and segregate them. That's wrong and racist.
That's an inside joke referring to the administrators' reaction to Ed Burns' little pilot program where he was taking the
unacclimated.
Yeah, he was taking the acclimated kids under his own wing into small class sizes.
He wanted the unacclimated kids who were corner kids,
right,
and there were like five of them in a class, and they're... Because there's a common misconception that like all the kids are, you know, like crazy, when in reality, like he was working with acclimated kids, but there were so many more of them that there were like 35 to 40 of them stuck in like classrooms while there's like five kids in like another big classroom. But hey, record rates like of awards for the kids who are in the acclimated classes, right?
They're
like,
right, yeah.
So that kind of like diminishes or maybe proves his theory, you know, that if those kids could have had that all the time, they would have like gone to college for, you know, the full 4 years and not come back to Baltimore, because there's a whole study about that, right? Apparently.
Yeah. Apparently. Yeah.
I got to get into that. You know.
But anyway, Dookie gets beat up by the Terrace Boys.
You know, he's kind of proved himself prior to that as being really intelligent, because he knows that the homing pigeon that they're going after, quote unquote homing pigeon, isn't a real one, because it doesn't have the identifying tags, which he's already seen working in Marlowe's coops, which is pretty crazy to think. I'm like, holy shoot, like Dookie's already in the thick of it. He doesn't even know it. Like he's like, better not like mess up that chicken coop.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
He could have disappeared, but luckily, you know, he's just retaining knowledge. And yeah, only Naaman and the guys and their crew can beat Dookie up. Not the Terrace Boys.
Yeah.
So do you think that was like a deliberate plant by Ed Burns using the Terrace Boys? Because after Lexington Terrace fell, like the real ones, there was like a gang or a group like that was pretty notorious in the early 2000s. And Ed Burns actually went to their trials and argued against imposing the death penalty.
Jesus.
Because he's like, you didn't grow up in Lexington, like in the neighborhood near where they used to stand. He's like, you don't know what it's like, so you can't sentence these kids to death because you don't understand. And I think it worked.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah. So what do you think? Like peeing in balloons, Willie? Is this...
I never did that myself.
I've heard it, but it's like...
Yeah, it seems like it's kind of hard to pull off in more ways than one.
Oh, yeah? Well,
no, I don't know.
What are you trying to say? Well, we just knew people to just take a actual just cup. You know?
Oh, yeah, cup. Yeah. I mean...
We're touching on book reports and science camp trauma.
No. Yeah. But yeah, being a kid growing up and, you know, you get beat up by somebody, it's a rough world, and like the methods you choose to retaliate can sometimes be pretty gnarly and gross. And then like after you're in the midst of like enacting your revenge plan, do you realize how stupid and half-baked it all is, which is evidenced by Namond exploding, the piss balloon on himself, and then and then them all running away and resulting in Michael getting the shit beaten out of him, while Naaman sees it and runs away cowardly, not offering to help his friend out.
It's like pretty revealing of who Naaman is. At this point, you know, Mike's like, everyone's still pretty innocent. Even, right. You know, Naaman retains a lot of that. He actually, like we've talked about to start this episode, you know, gets out of the game and gets away cleaner than mostly everyone. Like, is this scene like a metaphor, like foreshadowing that? Like he's escaping, you know, while Mike gets stuck.
But yeah, and then like this whole scene of them like meeting up afterwards in front of the ice cream truck with like Turkey in the Straw playing in the background, but like really like weird, like distorted from that, like, you know, beat up ice cream truck, which is kind of like, I don't know, like we all have memories of running out to the ice cream truck as kids and like getting excited about buying the little Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles ice cream sickle with the gumball eyes and all that, like really sweet, innocent picture of childhood. But like the way that like the music, by the way, diegetic music.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been a while since that.
That's being played on the soundtrack here, and how it's like all distorted, I feel like is a pretty effective commentary on like the really like backwards childhood that they're experiencing in this moment, where they could have like, you know, cornerstone moments like this of them all like sharing a moment of bonding over some tasty sugary treats, but the context behind it all of like them getting beat on it is pretty brutal.
I mean, that's a very vivid memory of the Ninja Turtle pop things. I don't remember. I'm like different, man. Different experiences. And then kind of like, you know, Naaman's kind of guiltily giving Michael a dollar.
Yeah.
I mean, you could already kind of see the dynamic, like the power dynamics of the crew.
Right.
You know, he already like is the one who initiated the ambush by like classic D's nuts line and going after two guys at once. And then now he's like, you know, basically kind of rather diplomatically getting Naaman to admit that he's a coward, right?
Yeah.
Because he's kind of just like got away. Like he just, no, I don't even need to, you know, less is more.
Exactly. Yeah.
As he could already see that. You know, he doesn't even have to like put him on blast, and Naaman already knows, and he's like, oh shit.
Yeah.
So gives him a dollar. He like pocket checks his friend.
Yeah.
It's a whole different story. Okay, so I don't know. Anything else you want to get into about the boys of summer? Like, or you want to talk about like their school, like their future school environment?
Let's talk about Tillman Middle School, yeah.
West Side, you know? But yeah, you know, they got a... Tootsie Duvall playing Marcia Donnelly, or Marcia?
I think it's Marcia.
Marcia, the assistant principal, right?
Yeah.
And she's pretty phenomenal. She's got like voted like, the number one authentic Ballmer accent.
Yeah, it's quite a sight to behold. It's like I could almost like close my eyes and listen to her talk. Her accent is so thick. It's
it's different.
Yeah.
Her, and then they kind of like, well, we'll talk about the Western District, but then, you know, kind of her and Real Landsman got the
authentic Ballmer. Yeah,
Ballmerese. So they're discussing how everyone's leaving. Yeah. Teachers are, you know, the turnover is very severe.
Yeah.
People are leaving to the county for better gigs and not trying to deal with the torment, you know.
But,
you know, unable to handle the kids and survive. So, but there's someone arriving.
Yeah, Presbo.
And checked in by
Tyreka Freeman.
I just kind of mentioned, you know, like a little tie into the Geo stuff with the, you know, Fayette, you know, Mafia or whatever, the crew, the Boys of Summer, and DeAndre McCullough, and that's like his baby mama, right?
Okay, nice.
From the corner, so
I was a little lost there for a second, but thank you for bringing me back into the fold. I know who that is now.
You know, he's
I remember her character.
So she's like the young love of DeAndre and has his kids, and right. You know, I'm sure Fran and, you know, her still got along at that point.
Yeah, but grandkids. But Przybylski is embarking on a new chapter in his life, and he's shown his classroom, which is of Vice Principal Donnelly. His classroom that he's supposed to be teaching in is, of course, in total disarray with, you know, flipped over desks and trash strewn about. And this kind of, you know, again, with like parallels and details, you know, representing themselves, this gave me strong like season one vibes of the detail, like coming into their dilapidated office space to do all their work, and Prez kind of reminding himself that this is going to be like a challenge that's before him, but he's going to do his best to turn this dilapidated classroom into a place of efficient learning. And he's going to have, you know, the bulletin board with all the leads and suspects strewn about, you know, that his chalkboard is going to be just as important as that bulletin board. So
yeah,
he's going to turn this into his own personal detail office.
He needs someone to help with like the details of his new... Never mind. Dookie's going to help him on the paper trail like Freeman.
Right, there you go.
And he has no gun.
Yeah.
Oh, which is better for everyone. But why... I know I'm being very facetious, I guess, or nitpicky, you know. You're like, yeah, you know you are. You always annoy me. But why does he... Like, so he's had this career, or short-lived police career, full of, you know, awful events and behavior, and, you know, culminating in him killing a cop. And why is he staying in the city of Baltimore? Is that where it's easiest to get a job with his background? Like, is the county out of reach when they look like, oh, you're a cop who was on the news?
Well, maybe killing. His wife wants to stay in Baltimore, and she wants to remain close to her father, Stan Velchek.
Yeah, they probably got like a nice, I mean, they do have a nice house, but do we know that like they live in the city of Baltimore definitively? Because maybe they've already like moved to the county. Well, anyway, my whole thing is like, you know, it is kind of like, I don't know if Admirable and Prez go in the same sentence, but I mean, at least he's like trying to confront some of his past in like a very intense way.
This is his stand and deliver season.
Yeah, basically. So, but apparently it holds a lot of merit that even though he's a cop with, you know, an awful record, who basically, you know, was fired or resigned, and even though it could have been much worse had he been actually held accountable, you know, being a police in the city is like, oh, yeah. What is it? Claude, the principal?
Oh, man,
should have done my homework. Everyone, you can hear the disappointment in Willie's voice when I couldn't deliver. He's like, oh, not again, Jacob.
No.
He's like, I'm a police.
Claudel Withers.
I got part of it.
Yeah.
My knowledge of Claude withered. But yeah, it's like a big thing, you know. They don't even care, like, they don't even know who he is.
I know.
Even though it's the most distinctive name. But yeah, him being a cop, even though a bad one, is still like, wow, okay. So they just,
the job right there on the spot.
Yeah, but it's because he has like these phenomenal interpersonal skills, or is it because they think like, oh, you must be tough. So what tactics from the street can you actually utilize? I mean, everyone talks about a prison, school to prison pipeline. So, right.
Well, as I recall, later on in the season, he does meet them halfway or whatever, because he's like teaching statistics or math wrapped up in like a lesson about playing craps. So
yeah, there you go. I guess it's like, I mean, I understand, you know, like his knowledge, like even though he was in the office where he should be, like he does have some like street knowledge. So that's maybe, that's a great point. Like they're going like, oh, this is a white guy, but he has like an understanding of black people, even if he's like spending his time locking them up or beating them or.
Yeah. Blinding them. Yeah.
It's something they think. I mean, it's like they're short three and math two and. Three in science, two in math. I don't know. It's just crazy.
Four in science. No, I can't do it.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous.
This is another thing, though, where I know we're like, oh, this is, you know, in no way is this a parallel to any of like our experiences when you really get down to it. But I'm like, oh, vacancies. Like, how many times in our experience at middle school was like, did you know someone or even experience where you're like, oh, yeah, like, we just lost a year of math because all we had were substitutes or,
yeah,
like, teachers couldn't handle being bullied, quit, and it's like, and then basically when I was subbing, that was my main jobs were going into those situations, like, oh, a teacher just quit 2 days before school started,
yeah,
and got a better job, you know, even though we're more in common, like, have more in common with the county, they went to, like, a better county.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, now I'm here, and, like, these kids have no chance, really, because I'm doing my best, but
yeah. Apparently, my 10th grade English teacher, I heard through the grapevine, quit her job pretty frustratedly because I think she like blamed her miscarriage on her students. And then there, you know, like in my senior year, American government economics teacher had to quit because he knocked up one of his students. So there's always. I think there's always vacancies due to incompetence on... No, I really liked my 10th grade English teacher, actually.
Like, my math teacher quit. He was from Mexico. He was really nice, but, like, kids just made fun of his accent and then threw stuff and, like, beat on the desk, like, make drum beats and had rap battles, and then he just quit after, like, 5 days. So, luckily, I had a parent who was like, oh, you're going to transfer out of that class, but a lot of other people just got stuck there.
Yeah.
And then... Like, I remember kids getting, like, arrested for throwing a desk at their old teacher and them quitting and stuff.
It's yeah, like, I mean, this, that, and they kind of touch on that in the whole IALAC, I am lovable and capable teacher training.
I am lovable and capable. That's segment. Why we come back, Willie.
Yeah, like, a lot of teachers are calling bullshit on the whole... Band-aid that this, you know, corporate acronym is for like a situation that's untenable where somebody's like throwing their full book bags through windows, breaking them and screwing up pencil sharpeners, which kind of like fits into my whole theory that kids are like really terrifying and I never want to be at the receiving end of getting burned by a bunch of middle schoolers.
Middle school is the toughest, they say, and in my part-time experience, have a lot of part-time experience dealing with eighth grade. It is some scary stuff.
Yeah,
but you'd be fine. I mean, no, but that's definitely from one of those editorials we studied up on, right? Where Ed Burns is like, they can tell you to do the seating chart and be mindful of where this pencil sharpeners place because that's a hot spot, but then it doesn't matter if, and then I wonder if the names that they're using are like actual kids where Ed Burns is like, I remember when Damari Stevenson or whatever.
I feel like Ed Burns was probably a cool, like,
yeah, he was cool.
He's a good,
there's
a good
definitely
guy.
Were like corner boys who like left or dropped out after going to high school that came by probably and were still like, what's up, Mr. Burns? Ah, oh, Mr. Burns. Excellent. I don't give a fuck, actually.
Yeah, that's probably what happened.
I feel like
I pretty much said
But how does that, you know, translate? So, it's juxtaposed with the cop stuff.
Right, with their like bullshit little you know, corporate training that's going on. So we see in both situations people kind of rolling their eyes at a lot of the
counterterrorism training.
Right, yeah. Tedious like bookwork presentations they have to go through. Yeah, which is just fitting into Simon's whole theory about like how institutions have become too big and unwieldy to like make any difference.
Yeah, because they're like, if, you know, the terrorists came and blew up West Baltimore, would anyone care? Kind of like echoing McNulty's comments when on his failed date with Mick knocking a dagger, Stino.
D'Agostino. Yeah.
Basically, they're, you know, Carver's reiterating McNulty's comments about, you know, politicians wouldn't know West Baltimore from, you know, anywhere else because no one cares, like you said. So, and they're like, you want to see some real terrorists? Come up to Pensy and Gold. And then Carver's talking about, like, Apex is going to drop you off at Lincoln Park. And isn't, like, Apex from, I think they bring up.
A man.
Yeah, he's, like, in the corner, and he's, like, one of Omar's, you know, parts of his character. Yeah. Composition. So, you know, but Santangelo, he's just, like, about it, man. He's, like, Thug Life. He just dumps it in. Like, how much paper budget? And then he doesn't care. So McNulty is actually, he's grabbing that binder.
For his kids.
But yeah, I mean, what else do we make of that scene? You're very succinct in
this
analysis.
The whole fruit murder is coming full circle, where Bunk is kind of assigned to it, and he feels compelled to kind of pull his coat. He fakes humping him from behind.
Yeah. And then he's like, wait, why don't you want to get drunk with me?
Yeah.
I just, like, you know, kind of assaulted you.
McNulty is really domesticated at this point, but he, like a good police, he sees when another cop is making strides in his own career and is kind of like leveling up. So McNulty gives Carver a letter of recommendation, speak, to Bunk to get him to collaborate on the whole Lex issue.
Because Carver's been doing more community policing, showing Calicio you can't just beat people because, you know, who are you going to turn to?
When you busted all the hit. Yeah.
It turns out that this would have actually, you know, helped out his new strategy, but like we kind of let off with, it's too late and Lex has been... I mean, it's not Randy's fault, but he is very gullible. So
yeah,
he took the bait.
Yeah,
and you know, gets walked to a vacant. So
right,
which is compounded by little Kevin sharing. Like, basically, it's all little Kevin's fault that Randy ends up the way he does. Right. As much as we want to like sit here, I want to sit here and be like, man, Carver sucks. ACAB, but not as much as Treme. As well, he's explain true. Why Treme is more
because there's only one sympathetic cop character in the whole show, and he's like trying to, you know, rat everybody out for being like incompetent and corrupt, and like the whole department is working against him and like calling him a snitch and shit, and like threatening his safety and his life. He's like one person going up against the system, and the system like more or less win. Well, I, you know, it's a whole different podcast.
I gotta watch Treme, man. Yeah. Treme cast.
No. Treme, like, I think if you watch it, you'll realize, Treme is a lot more critical of like
the police
than The Wire is.
Yeah, I mean, I just remember the big investigation, like the Danziger thing, and how people were like, it's not The Wire, because I'm like, yeah, it's not a cop show. Like, this is cool. It's about like culture and different things. And there's one cop, but it's like not about, you know, it's like crime happens. But
yeah, The Wire is more about the essential workers, and then Treme is more about the cultural workers, like
part-time workers,
the restaurateurs and the musicians and Indian chiefs and whatnot. Do we have anything left to say about this episode?
Forget Norris, man. It's all about Norris Davis.
That's right.
Anyways, Ed Norris is back, and he's awesome.
Yeah.
Apparently, Justin Fenton, you know, also agreed a little bit with, you know, criticism of Norris.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, again, time shows timelessness. me saying potentially factually incorrect things about Norris's philandering, and you know, he's gonna come after me. Scary shit. I'll fact check it. I got an archives database login. Don't cancel it.
Okay. Nice.
We're good, man. We're right on. Woo! Hour 15, Willie.
Yeah.
How are we good? Well, it took time, Willie, for us to hone down the video stuff, and then we got better at it, and now we're just like working towards that in person. But it's fun. Right. And that was fun talking about Boys of Summer.
Right.
So
thank you to everybody who's made it this far. You know, if you listen to this and you still feel like you want to connect with us, check us out on social media. We're up on all the platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We're posting, so respond, please. Talk to us. Anybody out there? Is there anybody out there? Are we just talking into the void?
Into the is this all some weird... This is like part of the simulation.
Hit the likes and subscribe buttons.
Yeah,
and those. Let us know that we have friends out there.
Yeah, even if it's like 5 years from now. It's like, Willie, what do we do, man? I'm no longer interested in The Wire, but we've got someone heard our plea to connect with us. And also, if you don't feel like you're doing it that way, 10 years from now and want to go to the godswillnotsaveyou@gmail.com and drop a question, comment, or concern, we'll definitely still have the login available.
Yeah.
So do that. You know, we'd like to hear from you. We'll respond. I haven't checked the email in far too long, but Willie's very diligent.
Willigent.
He's willigent. Willing and diligent.
Yeah.
And then shout out to our creative team who, you know, really great guys, one being Mostart, who hooked it up with the original music for our intro, outro, and bumper music. Keeps everyone engaged. Check them out. Really great stuff at Mostart.com.
Yeah, and also big thank you to Andre Tesnes, who did the great graphic design for our podcast logo.
Great guy, better artist.
Oh, shit.
Oh, wait. Great artist, better man.
You don't mean that. All right. Thank you, everybody.